This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you, in part, by Patreon supporters. Thank you, guys. Patreon tipsters get after-show episodes, bonus book reviews, and more. So consider becoming a Blotter Presents tipster your own selves at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, the episode.
Just then, the White House steward steps forward and whispers in Jefferson's ear,
"Mr. President, what should we do with the cheese wheel, sir? What else? Cut it."
He should have warned me!
It is election week here in the U.S. And with high crimes and misdemeanors on our minds, Eve Beatty and I are talking about Wondery's American Elections Wicked Game on the theory that it won't take that show long to get to some kind of felony. We're also talking about The Fear of 13, a 2015 documentary about a convicted murderer whose Gary Gilmore-ing of his own death row status had a surprising outcome. Less surprising, I am still kind of laughing about Cut the Cheese, and I'm going to be for a while, so light a match. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 119. It was only a matter of time before my love of fart humor outweighed my respect for crime victims. It took 119 episodes, but here we are at the bottom. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that tries to find the true crime that's worth your time. I'm joined again today by Eve Beatty, unless she's quit over my immature fart humor, but it sounds like she's still here. Eve?
Sarah, I would be a hypocrite if I quit over something like that. I mean, that's basically still my stock and trade at age 48 or whatever I am. Yeah.
Today on our Most Wanted section, we're talking about a relatively new podcast called American Elections Wicked Game. I believe it actually debuted a month ago. But I wanted to make sure that there were enough episodes so that surely there would be some crime that occurred in the course of early American history. Just in case you're not familiar with what exactly they're doing over there, here's the case file on the podcast. Like the Washington Post did a few years back on the eve of the 2016 election in their series on each American president, Wondery has set out, quote, to review the entire history of presidential elections from the unanimous and inevitable election of George Washington in 1789 to Donald Trump's surprise electoral victory in 2016. Nice qualifier there, end quote. Host Lindsey Graham, no relation, is the host. And also, I think, all of the reenactment actors. As we're recording this, I think they dropped a new episode this morning about the 1808 elections. I didn't listen to that one yet, but I've heard all the others. Eve, how many of these did you get through, and what did you think overall?
I got through 1.5.
So, time management issue? Or it's just not for you?
Partially time management. I think that, you know, like housekeeping wise, that was all I sort of got in my neither watching television nor actually working time. I mean, when I do the show, I always try to actually pay attention to the stuff. But I also think that if I had been doing this on my own for fun, I probably would not have made it that long.
I think that this is, I mean, I think if you liked, I've forgotten the name of that Washington Post series, but I will dig it up and we'll put it in the show notes. I think if you like that one, and if you like Hardcore History with Dan Carlin, if you liked Slow Burn, this is probably something that you'll enjoy. Lindsey Graham does have some like occasional weird pronunciations and locutions that slip in, like divisive. I guess that's not incorrect, but it was like clank. But this is definitely one that I had it on in the car to drive to Westchester, and it was perfect for that. I felt like I was learning something, but it wasn't something I had to pay super close attention to. And it's great for that. I think it's a good commute podcast. You can feel like you're osmoting some
information. Well, what I was going to say is, I mean, part of this is personal taste as opposed to an actual, like, sort of bad or good, you know, personal taste and what you like in entertainment. Like, right. Spoiler alert, what I'm going to... My sort of thinking about both of the properties that we're discussing today is that they could have benefited from a format swap. I think that this would have been more interesting as a video product where I could actually watch it. And I think that the thing that we're going to talk about in the cold case would have been more interesting as a podcast. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But and the reason that I sort of wished that this were a TV show instead of a podcast is because it's not that the content was uninteresting or uncompelling, but when I'm listening to a podcast and it's there in my head, when people are saying things like, excuse me, Washington paused for a moment. He looked up. He looked back down. He looked at his notes. I think, well, how the hell do you know that he did that? Like, I felt like there were enough sort of editorial flourishes. Like, you know, no one's like giving me any sort of any idea. Like, obviously when someone's saying an exact quote, like, and then he said blah de blah de blah de blah, that probably came from a history that someone wrote. Yeah, sure. But all of these other things where it's like, Washington enjoyed dancing and this and that. Well, how do we know that? Like, I kept like going back and, you know, just sort of wanting to edit it and be like, so okay, so where's your citation for, like, you know, there, the air was so cold that their breath hung in it. I don't have an objection to that were this a scripted podcast that was fictional. But since this is actual for real history, I wouldn't object to that if I was watching a show and that happened. But when you're just saying it to me or reading it to me, I'm, you know, I sort of
feel
I'd like...
I'd almost rather have someone be like... I don't know. Official Republican historian Otis Frambolator reported that the air was so cold that what my father would call no sticking cold. Like, you pinch your nostrils together and they stick that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm
give us a letter or something. Like, you know, myriad witnesses said it was freezing.
Just make it video so that way, because I'll accept that if you have actors doing this stuff or reenactors or whatever you want to call it. Like, I won't sort of, I mean, because I know that you have to, you know, that you have to sort of put some stuff in there about looking up and looking down again, and I'm not going to be a pedant about that. But when you're just saying the words to me, it's problematic. But the thing is, like, you know, the solution isn't to remove all of the local color, because then it would become deadly dull. That's why I feel like the solution is to make it video. So, but I also would like to talk about the cake, so we can get to that in a minute.
Yeah, I did like that. Some of the stuff that you're talking about, I agree that I would have preferred more citations and less. Did you ever read Irving Stone books when you were a kid?
Like, that sounds familiar.
I think The Agony and the Ecstasy was about Van Gogh. So he had and we had to read one at my school that was basically about John and Abigail Adams. And this, like, not regency-ing. And that's, like, a little bit dismissive of Regency novels, but this, like, the novelization of history that was viewed as an easy way to get, you know, rising ninth graders to get their dose of history over the summer, even though these books were doorstops. Anyway, I don't object to that in theory. In practice, I agree with you. I would rather have the citations. But what I did like about it is that it did seem... authoritative enough, and it also, like, brought Washington down to a manageable figure in some ways. Like, there was a description of his reedy voice. There were like those little details, like, that, you know, 100 200 years ago, like, the world was literally a lot colder most of the time than it is now. So little details like that. The transport of the aforementioned giant wheel of cheese, which West Wing watchers, like, I won't get into it. I thought that was a Jacksonian thing, but anyway, that this regularly happened. Like, people would just show up with, like, an elephant at the front door of the White House and be like, this is for you, happy inauguration. And they just, like, be like, thanks. And they'd sign for it. I don't know. it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I loved all of those like little details, but then there were other details that I felt were like unnecessary. Like, I'll give you an example. They said, you know, Washington strode into the room and he was a giant of a man. And by giant of a
tall.
Man,
I know, like
6 feet turned to pounds. And I was like, well, you know, my husband is 5'11 and in excess of 200 pounds, and he is not a giant of a man. And I know that people were smaller back then, but not by that much.
Well, I think they actually were, but first of all, I think the jump came with like fluoridated water, which was relatively recent. And second of all, that did need a line of context or like four words. A giant of the time.
Yeah, yeah. Or like, you know, everybody else was so poorly nourished because, you know, the British people weren't letting people eat. Or, you know, or like all the stuff like, Washington was virtually bulletproof. And then they say all these different times, like, he wove through the bullets on the battlefield. Once again, it's like, this is something that I feel like if I had been watching this on TV, they could have given it to me. I would have eaten it. You know, they could have just given me a flashback where he was doing all this stuff. Like, that's going through his head as he's, because this was within the context of Washington's, like, wagon. How many, by the way, how many horses died because Washington just like couldn't walk? You know, his like wagon's like plummeting off the thing, but he somehow managed to survive this
fall.
Well,
that was a little unclear, like how, if it's a four in hand, like how did just one horse fall off the side?
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah, but then like all these other horses died when he was doing all this other stuff too, which I sort of wanted to be like, you know, I would prefer maybe a scene in the stable where all the horses are like, oh, no, it's not my turn, guys. But
I know, not old Washy again. Forget it.
Yeah. I mean, I
ate the short straw. Fuck you.
I understand why this stuff has to go on there. Like, obviously, it's going to be, it would be really, otherwise, I'd be here complaining about how boring it is. But a lot of this felt like, if you're here and you're telling me that the reason you're giving me this information is to help me better understand why, our current administration and the election leading up to it isn't that unusual. You're attempting to contextualize that for me in a real hard news sort of way. Then you can't like have all of these sort of floofy things that may or may not be accurate.
Or just make it as textural as it's going to be. Like, I think there are probably certain elections where you're not going to get the apparently standard 42 to 46 minutes.
Yeah.
Out of it, like, I mean, I don't remember it that well, but I just have a feeling the 1984 re-election of Reagan, it'll be like, oh, well, there was a woman running mate from the opposition. And that's kind of the extent of the interest of it, except that Reagan was clearly already showing signs of dementia. Okay, maybe I'm talking myself out of this, but I really enjoy, if anyone read or I listened to it as an audiobook. I believe it's called American Lion, and it's about Andrew Jackson and the number of like at close range hand-to-hand combat assassination attempts, plural, that he survived primarily because people, like, he was just a mean cuss. And also guns worked like shit until like 1860. Like, like, if you're firing something called a blunderbuss, you've got, like, a 2 in 10 shot of hitting anything, of it not blowing up in your face. So stuff like that, like, I'm going to play a clip before we talk too much longer, because the account of this, like, how dare you, no, how dare you, sir, flap between a couple of congressmen, one of whom spat tobacco chews and the entire plug of tobacco in the other one's face. And then the other one, like, waited, like, posted up in the high weeds. And then this happened.
2 weeks later, Griswold had his revenge. He attacked Lyon with a wooden cane, striking him repeatedly. Lyon defended himself with a pair of tongs from a nearby fireplace. The men brawled on the floor of the house and traded punches before they were pulled apart by their colleagues. The underlying cause of the Griswold-Lyon scuffle was personal, but it was also political.
Well, okay, that is like a filler sentence that it's like, well, we know. They were in the House of Representatives, we can assume. That it wasn't just like, I don't like your face. But there's something about the fact that in the far reaches of the past of this country, to get in and out of a day was an extremely dangerous proposition in ways that we can't relate to. Like, I just pulled off a hangnail. It's probably going to get infected. That could have killed me at the time that they're talking about. Like, they're fighting each other with tongs and slapping each other with gloves. And there is something hilariously quaint about it, especially since even though you know it's fireplace tongs, like, I'm just picturing like a, like salad tongs.
Oh, I went straight to fondue, yeah.
Yeah, that he just like grabs them off his desk and is like clackety clack clack clack, fuck you. Like, I find that amusing, but this is how life was lived and disputes were settled. And, it, you know, short of an actual duel, and we'll get into that later. But I'm looking forward to consuming the rest of this for the same reason that it's like, I like history to be read to me. And it, I think it would also be very good to fall asleep by. Is that where the halfway point comes in for you, that you were like, I'll listen to this before bed and then zonk, or you just stopped?
I'm trying to think. No, I think it really was like, well, I'm done cleaning the kitchen.
Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, and so it wasn't like anything, like it wasn't something like where I like flounced off in a huff or anything like that. But, you know, something that you just said, you know, that clip that you chose sort of makes me realize that part of the problem here is that I think that the thesis is not necessarily flawed. I don't think that there's anything wrong with saying, listen, the time when you think was like the golden era of government never existed. I like that. I think that that's something that people, you know, I wish that's something that people would point out more about journalism, because everyone's like, oh, it's so terrible. And I'm like, yeah, you know, journalism didn't get really, you know, straight and unbiased until the 70s. But I also think that no one is arguing that things were, you know, basically an episode of Madam Secretary or something back when, you know, Washington was in charge. I think everybody knows that, you know, life was weird and rough and tumble when this democracy was being formed. And that's why everything was so strange and kind of a pain in the ass. And I think that this just should have started later. I would have, if I were doing this show, I would have started at Kennedy, because that's, you know, what we think of. I don't know, maybe Lincoln, probably not though. But I think I would have started with Kennedy, because that's the sort of like, we sort of think to ourselves, things were established by then. Everybody knew what the script was and how things work. And, you know, sort of like, you know, all the sort of points of order that and rules of order, that's what I meant to say, you know, about how everything goes and checks and balances and all that stuff was already in place. So start with something like Kennedy that everybody loves and everybody had a picture of him on the wall or their grandma did or whatever. And, you know, start deconstructing stuff at that point, as opposed to going back to, you know, when to freaking Monticello or whatever. I mean, because Everybody knows that this country was terrible then, because it was everyone owned slaves, even the quote unquote good guys, and everyone was shooting each other and everyone was terrible and everybody, you know, hated women and all that. Like, oh no, I'm so shocked that things were bad back then when women weren't allowed to vote and people owned each other.
Yeah, but I think that maybe that's not something that a lot of people know. And I feel like I know that, but I know that I couldn't necessarily fill anything in about that. So I liked this detail. I liked the sort of Ken Burnsy, like, this is informative if I'm awake, but if I'm trying to fall asleep, it's also soothing. it's the perfect balance. It's like watching Ken Burns's country music. Like, there are a couple of episodes that I've had to restart like three times, and it's not because it's boring. It's because it's absolutely predictable and so chock full of information that it's like, well, you know, tomorrow night I will pick back up 10 minutes later. I think it might also,
you know what,
be...
I think maybe what it is that this, you said that you like having history read to you. I think this would be a great audiobook.
Yeah,
but I have different expectations for podcasts, and that's on me. That's not on the show.
Well, I do think that there are a couple of episodes here where they're really reaching to include, all right, I'm going to play another clip. I'm going to back up to clip two. This is something that I didn't necessarily know. I have never seen Hamilton. I've never listened to the soundtrack. I'm that Mennonite. But I have wondered in passing, like, well, why didn't that guy become president? Like, he was definitely in the line. What
you didn't see
that?
The milk commercial?
I did see the milk commercial. We'll get to Aaron Burr in a moment. But that's not why he wasn't president. It's why he wasn't alive. but some of this was news to me, but I do feel like Hamilton figures so heavily in the early episodes, not necessarily because he was actually that germane to the elections, although this podcast makes it sound like he was, but because he's a name that people know, and this information is information people have because of Miranda. So here's clip two.
But the whole affair was a setup. Mariah and her husband had laid a trap, and soon Hamilton was making frequent hush money payments to the husband, who was threatening to expose Hamilton's infidelity. Hamilton had every reason to want to keep this scandal under wraps, his wife Eliza for one, his political ambitions for another. But perhaps, though, there was still yet another reason. His relationship with President George Washington. Since the war, Hamilton had been Washington's most trusted advisor. If Hamilton's secret were to be made public, it would bring shame not only on him, but on George Washington, a man Hamilton loved and feared in equal measure.
I sort of wanted more of the episode to be about that, about this weird, like, paternal, I don't know, this, like, filial feeling that Hamilton had towards Washington. But it's also like, well, he was never elected, and this is why. I mean, the rest of North America had this information because of the musical. I didn't, and I was like, okay, interesting. But is this crimey enough? Is our other topic? And you don't necessarily get into, like, Hamilton was being extorted by this Reynolds person's husband and various Congress people who were not about having a central bank. And then people were constantly blackmailing these dudes because these dudes were constantly fucking the help. Not consensually in certain cases. Here's clip four.
Unlike his accusation that Jefferson paid him for his political writings, Callender did little in the way of offering proof of the Sally Hemings affair. Still, the veracity of his accusation has been largely verified. DNA evidence has now proven Jefferson did father Sally's children. But there is no consensus among modern historians about whether the relationship was consensual. Callender didn't stop with Sally Hemings. He accused Jefferson of having an affair with the wife of his neighbor and of using depreciated currency to pay off debts during the Revolutionary War.
Not depreciated currency.
If I had made it to that part of the episode, I might have flounced out at the no consensus part, though. That might have been a flounce moment for me.
Yeah, I just don't, like, even if it's your understanding that there is no consensus, there should be, so just leave that part out.
There historical consensus that Thomas Jefferson then enslaved his own children? That
yeah.
He had Sally Hemings? I mean, there is historical consensus on that. If you're going to
give him is there not consensus on what slavery means?
I mean, like, whatever. We could spend our whole lives, you know, just like at tweeting news organizations that use the word sex and rape cases in their headlines, too. But, you know, this is just one of those things where I feel like having a pair of eyes on some of this stuff. This is like where diversity reading or whatever is important, and having a diversity in the room. That obviously this speaks a lack of women who are thinking about this stuff, or people of color who have their ears on this. And I think that that's problematic for every publication. And I know this is like a glass houses thing, because I've worked at a lot of places where it's all white people. But, you know, once again, you know, like coming at this, like, you know, from a writer, you know, as you are too, it's just like, everybody should know better at this point. Everybody, you have the right person there helping you out. This gets fixed.
Well, and it takes, you know, 5 to 15 minutes to read this out and to be like, I mean, who's whiter than me? Almost no one. This Lindsey Graham, maybe. Other Lindsey Graham for sure. My dad? end of list. But it's like, it, just read this out and, you know, if nothing else, maybe don't put like the fact that he had, quote, an affair with someone he owned who was three-fifths of a citizen next to depreciated currency. And
yeah.
Here's the other thing. Like, it also takes 5 to 15 minutes to be like, let's give a background paragraph on the fact that this was fucked up. And then let's either cut the bit about depreciated currency.
Yeah.
Or give another sentence in context about the fact that this was considered just as serious on a scandal basis at the time and how fucked up that is. And then let's explain why that was a problem to the one person in the listenership who cares about like specie extortion, which is Sarah D. Bunting. Like, no one else cares, but if you're going to bring it up, give Buncey some love and explain why that was a problem. And then explain why you're putting that in the same sentence as they thought it was a scandalous affair. It was actually rape. And, you know.
Maybe someone can help explain it to you on Twitter, Sarah. Here's hoping.
I'm sure. Twitter bros, come at me. Actually, I could just Google it. I'm good like that. Yeah, this isn't in the early going all that crimey. So I think if your point is taken about maybe starting with Kennedy or like an election that it might not necessarily be in the memory of the listenership, but it is like someone that you've seen moving picture footage of. Mm-hmm. And it's not just like daguerreotypes of people in stovepipe hats or, you know, what's funny. You'll see this in the visual aids, which you'll find on Twitter at Blotter Presents. But no matter who has rendered the portrait of Aaron Burr, he has a traveling eye. That's very obvious, and it's funny that that's never corrected. And you wonder if his, like, alleged villainy doesn't have something to do with the fact. Aaron Bear apparently is objecting again.
Are you saying that he is, like, that the artists who attempt to capture his visage try to make him appear sinister?
Yes. I think
okay, interesting.
I think that's correct.
Interesting.
Yeah, Aaron Burr... In college, I worked for the alternative newspaper. It wasn't the one named after the school. It was named something else. And we were in Aaron Burr Hall, and it was right around the time that that ad came out, actually. I'm pretty sure I am not able to say Aaron Burr without thinking, like, I can't do it. But Aaron Burr, like, what? What a story. Like, he's such a Nixon. And maybe that's who they should have started with. It's just the desperate striving of Aaron Burr. Because, as I said, I haven't seen Hamilton and I don't know the ins and outs. But most of America is extremely well acquainted because of that musical. And here's where you do get into a crime. Because Alexander Hamilton had made sure in New York State that dueling was illegal. And the fact that after a duel, he died on New York soil meant that Aaron Burr was possibly guilty of something. Here's our final clip from this section.
It is difficult to fathom that the Vice President of the United States shot and killed a former Treasury Secretary in a duel. The question of what transpired on that fateful morning, who fired first, and who had violent intentions, has been the subject of centuries-long debate. But here are the facts. On Wednesday, July 11th, 1804, at 7 a.m., Hamilton and Burr stood back-to-back on a cliff overlooking the Hudson River. In the presence of their seconds, both men walked their paces and fired their pistols. Intentional or not, Hamilton missed. Burr's aim was true. The next day, at 2 p.m., Hamilton died from the gunshot wound. The duel made Vice President Burr a fugitive from justice and put a swift end to his political career. He was never tried for Hamilton's death, although he would be charged with murder in both New York and New Jersey, though the charges would eventually be dropped.
And then he went on to be charged with various other villainous acts, and yet not ejected from the vice presidency. I guess shit was different back then. I mean, who hasn't killed a former Treasury Secretary in a duel, I ask you? Is that in my contract? It does take this podcast a while to get to real crimes. So if you are looking for a pure true crime experience, this is not it. This podcast also, I think, needs to obey the rhythms of its actual subjects a little bit better and not feel quite so obligated to come in at 40 to 50 minutes, although it's a Wondery production. They have ads to sell. I get that that's not necessarily possible. I, you know, my like history grandpa Buncey itch was scratched by this. I will continue listening, but, it, you know, I've listed a bunch of properties that I think it's like, and if those weren't for you, I think this might not be either, and it may take us a while to get into the real crimey stuff that we're expecting to hear in, like, the 60s.
Tell me when they get to, like, Kennedy and Nixon at the debate or something, and I'll tune back in. I just...
Yeah, that's going to be, like, next August, I think.
Oh, God.
Yeah, we've got all those, like, we've got all those dudes in the 1840s that it's like, there was a Tyler and a Taylor? Why? Van Buren, who cares?
Unless Tippecanoe and Tyler too, baby. That's one of my favorite mottos.
Yeah, that's a good one. Good old Tippy. All right, folks, once again, that's called American Elections, Wicked Game. It's a Wondery production. I probably will not do another Wondery property next week. Don't worry, I'm not in the pocket of big Wondery. But I did enjoy this. I think it's basically good. And like I said, if you're into Dan Carlin, if you're into Slow Burn, I think this will be for you. And if you have been listening, or you have like particular, I don't know, Chester Arthur Goss that I should be excited about when that episode comes in like January, let me know. That's at Blotter Presents on Twitter. Okay, so Eve thought that this would be better as a visual property, but she thought our cold case would work better as a podcast. This is documentary The Fear of 13. Here's the case file from the film's Wikipedia page. Quote, after more than 20 years on death row, a convicted murderer petitions the court asking to be executed. But as he tells his story, it gradually becomes clear that nothing is quite what it seems. End quote. That's some boilerplate, spoiler-proof copy right there. Nick Yaris of It Is Immediately Clear As Soon As He Opens His Mouth, Philadelphia, was convicted of murder at age 21 and sent to death row. He talks about his time in prison, his escape, his marriage, and his love affair with reading in a documentary done in a sort of Spalding Gray style. There are no other interviews, no real pan scans of the evidence like you might be used to, though a chyron at the beginning assures us the filmmaker's independently verified Yaris's version of events. I had been seeing this in the recommended for you section of Netflix for months on end, knew nothing about it, had never heard of this case. Eve, did you have any familiarity with the film or the case before we watched this?
I had familiarity with the case because I did, for some reason, I don't know why, remember like the exoneration stuff. Maybe I was looking for something else in the Innocence Project site at some point or something. So I remembered, you know, that he was a guy who had been on death row and had been exonerated due to, you know, DNA evidence and, you know, other stuff. And so I knew that, but I did not know that I guess he had appeared on another documentary as part of like Innocence Project stuff. And I think I might have seen that like at a film festival or something too. So I had this sort of vague familiarity, but I did not even know that this movie existed until you brought it up.
The stylistic choice is interesting. It's very, and as regular listeners know, I'm not one of those like documentaries and documentarians must be rigidly objective to the point of being a transcript people. Like, I think there's a lot of ways to get at a truth, and this is an interesting way. But when you read like the user reviews on IMDb or on Netflix, it's like, I found other viewers much more divided than I thought on Yaris himself. What did you think of him?
I mean, I thought he was fine. I mean, I don't know. I thought he was fine. I definitely, there's a link that we'll put in the show notes, an interview to Yaris where he talks about sort of the process of making the documentary and what his, you know, what his goals in terms of his participation were for it. And I love his goal, which was he wanted to talk about the importance of reading in his life, and he wanted to spread a message of positivity. And that's one of those things that he does even now. Like, he's a motivation, not a motivational speaker, right, but, you know, he's a speaker that goes and talks about, you know, how not to lose hope about stuff. And he doesn't seem like super Jesus-y or anything, so he's like cool with me. I thought he was fine. I like, you know, that you use sort of Spalding Gray as a comparison, I think is apt, that, you know, he's a guy telling his story, and I feel like it was edited in a way that made it interesting because it wasn't linear and all that. I would have rather had him in my ear where I could focus on him. It was difficult. And once again, this just could be on me. It was difficult for me just to focus on a guy talking for an hour and 35 minutes. And I would have easily been able to focus on it if he were just in my ear.
Because it really is just him, and then it's sort of interwoven with images that are not B-roll. Like, they were clearly shot for this, but it's not of, you know, actual people. It's not of evidence. It's just like he's talking about someone getting stabbed in the shower, and then that lunch was served 2 seconds later, and you see blood going down the drain, and then you hear like lunchroom sounds. And I think,
no, it's like when you go to Shutterstock and you sort of do a general search or something, because, like, you need something to use on a blog.
There's nothing wrong with
post.
That, but I agree that this is like an hour and 34 minutes. And as a podcast, like a podumentary, this could have been, I think, using the same sort of stock footage, but with sound, it's shorter to do. And it's like 50 minutes. The other issue is, I mean, I think other viewers found him unlikable and not credible and manipulative. I found him definitely, like, he is an autodidact, and it shows, and he has had years to think about how he wants to express these sentiments and, like, little koans about prison life, and that's very evident. Our next clip is from very early in the documentary, and this clip will decide you, I think, as to whether this is for you. First of all, not everybody can stand a Philly accent. Hey, Tara. This is just my grandma and my uncles and my dad, like, washing over me, so I have zero problem with that. But you'll also have to decide right at this point, I think, whether he has a DIY poesy to his speaking, or whether it's just manipulative and stagey sounding. No reason it can't be both, but here's clip 6.
The worst part, and yet the best part, of being in solitary confinement is time can be a blisteringly fast thing, where in the blink of an eye you can look and 10 years are gone from your life. But the next week is agony. It's like you look at your wristwatch, and instead of there being a face, there's a calendar, and it flips. But then if you look out the window, it takes all day for that sun to go down. I always wanted to tell somebody that.
Yeah, we can tell. Also, it always takes all day for the sun to go down. That's, like, I know what he's trying to say, but it's like,
See, a lot of that stuff, a lot of that stuff, and, you know, there are a lot of sort of, Hallmark-y sort of things here. I attributed that to the fact that, you know, so he goes into prison, he's essentially illiterate, and he starts to teach himself how to read, and in doing so, he ends up, like, falling into this whole world of sort of pulp novels, I think some of which were supplied to him by a sort of sympathetic guard. So he became this guy who was reading Elmore Leonard and blah, blah, blah. And so to me, this is a person whose sort of linguistic style was shaped by having, you know, living long stretches of his life in circumstances where he wasn't allowed to speak, and probably the only words in his head were these novels, you know? So it's going to stunt your growth.
Well, and I don't think there's, like, this is not a dumb guy. This is a pretty clever guy, as we hear when he's talking about his escape, which actually went pretty well, given that it was like 5 degrees below zero. And, you know, it was also the 80s. It was a little easier to get away with this shit and just like get on a plane. He's a pretty standard looking dude. But I enjoyed those parts the most because there was real texture and it didn't seem like received rhythms of storytelling to me in these parts. I managed to whittle it down to one clip. Here's clip 7.
When I went into the shop, the guy behind the counter, the owner, was obviously a criminal. So I told him, I don't have any identification, but I want to sell you this coat. So I negotiated with him to give me a gun and $100 for the coat, which was worth like $5,000, you know, a very nice fur coat. And so after he gave me the gun, he refused to give me bullets. So he asked me if I was willing to rob this guy that he knew, Anthony Manila, who had a collection of gold coins that were worth $350 each.
First of all, it's always fucking coins. You ever notice that? Like, whenever there's some, like, not fugazi, but just some, like, Rube Goldbergian crime plot, or, like, families are fighting with each other for, like, 2 generations, it is always coins. Like, this is why my grandma and her brother did not speak. Coins. Probably worth nothing. People just have this idea about coins. Like, there's something very literal about people's thinking about rare coins, that it's like, okay, like it always seems to come back to coins somehow in these stories. But what I really liked about this sequence was that quality of an anxiety nightmare that it had, where he's just like going from city to city and it's like, okay, now your next mission is to rob this guy. I'm not going to give you any bullets, but you got to rob this guy and get the coins. And then he goes to rob the guy and it's a whole thing. The guy jumps out of the car. I thought it was really, like, I thought it was interesting, and it made me sort of think about the processiness of his escape. I liked that part a lot. But overall, he does tend to seem, I mean, rehearsed is not a fair way to put it, because of course he rehearsed this, like, that's kind of the point of the structuring of this documentary. But a lot is going to depend on whether his delivery and the way in which he's trying to do this narrative is for you, and it may not be.
Yeah, I mean, it very easily could have been something where, you know, I know he's working on a book, and just since we're on Philly accents and stuff, when I think about Philly accents, I always think about the History of Violence, and that's because in the movie A History of Violence...
Oh, were there Philly accents in that? Because...
Oh, well, no, you should notice. Go, if you're a super dork, now I sound like Stefan, if you're a super dork, go find the DVD of A History of Violence, because one of the extras is this whole thing about how Viggo Mortensen ends up, like, palling around with Maria Bello, who I guess is a Philly native, like, Maria Bello's, like, yeah, family members, who are all, like, legit Philly people, and there's this phone call in there of one of Maria Bello's, like, you know, extended family members calling and saying, like, hey, Maria, I got the King of the Rings here. I apologize for my accent. I can't do it. But, you know, like, so Viggo's, like, running around with Maria's family, and that's how he worked on his accent. And I don't know if you remember William Hurt's accent, but it's just, like, some crazy fucking shit.
Yeah,
I don't know,
it had nothing to do. That was like, oh, are there Cajuns in West Philly now? Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because that's
was...
where William Hurt thinks he is. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah. It was wild. It was
New
it was
Orleans
wild.
On the Monongahela. Okay.
Well, I mean, I'm also saying, you know, as someone from Indiana, I don't know that we've ever had anyone who looks like Viggo Mortensen. living in our state, and, you know, more's the pity. But, you know, like, you could imagine this being a property that Viggo Mortensen would adapt and, you know, want to, you know, be part of or read, or, you know, some sort of thing with NPR, the Innocence Project or something like that. And, you know, since he already has the accent down, I'm sort of surprised that he didn't, because he too has that sort of wiry, you know, trucker speed sort of look that, you know, that Nick does. Like, so, I mean, I'm not like pitching like alternate projects or anything, but I'm just saying that I feel that Viggo Mortensen could have delivered Yaris's life story more convincingly than Yaris himself.
And if they do a scripted take on it, he would be good casting, actually.
Right. That's what I'm saying. He has that, you know, that
same cheekbones,
rangy sort of, you know what I mean? Like that little, like, trucker speed. You know, when I see guys like that, I always think trucker speed, you know, especially like if I'm out on the road. You know, I always think to myself, like, okay, that's the person you don't want to mess with because trucker speed.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. That, like, they're like gristle with a skull on top.
Yeah.
And you're like,
yeah.
But yeah, could is wired enough to kill me with one kick? Sure.
Sure.
There's another part in which he's talking about how, like, he pretty freely admits all the crazy shit he got up to when he was on trucker speed. You know, definitely not wrong on that count. But when it comes to this, the murder that he's convicted of, which he swears he didn't do, but like he tried to sell out some like frenemy of his for doing it. And when it became clear that that wasn't going to work, because that guy got sober and, like, had an alibi, the authorities come back to Nick Yaris and decide to hang it on him for the following reasons. Clip 8.
And I had more information than anyone else. It was all guesswork, but it didn't matter to them. I was charged with the abduction, rape, and murder of a woman I had never met in my life. I was already sitting in prison for the attempted murder of a police officer. I'm a 20-year-old drug addict who's been thrown out of his own house onto the streets by his own family. What chance do I have? No one's going to believe me.
The delivery on that is a little mawkish, but I just couldn't help thinking about how many times we have heard a variation on that from almost every false confession, wrongful conviction story that I've ever seen, particularly defendants of color, intellectually challenged defendants, any high profile unsolved from the 70s or the 80s, they were just like, well, the blood type is close enough. And there was a, you know, grossly similar hair on the body. We're going to close this. You knew some things because you saw it in the paper. You're going to jail. Just
and how I think sometimes
often
too, that
happened.
Whole, you've done something, you know. Every time you get pulled over for, you know, even if you weren't speeding this time, you sped some other time. So when you get pulled over, take the ticket. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was striking. A little disappointed in the delivery. But again, this isn't, you know, he's not Viggo Mortensen. So we'll just have to wait for that to perfect the story. I also was not crazy about, I know that this format does not allow it, but he, having just sort of given up on any hope due to various like corruption of evidence, chain of custody issues, Yaris has given up on being exonerated. So he would also like to just give up, period. He writes a letter to the judge, and it's after hearing a Patty Griffin song, which is then interwoven into this clip.
Dear Judge Giles, as a criminal plaintiff, I ask that one right that I have remaining to me as a condemned prisoner be recognized, and that is a condemned man's right to be executed. I hereby ask that counsel be dismissed, that my record be then transmitted to Governor Edward Rendell for my execution date to be set within 60 days of receipt of this letter.
Took a while to understand the beauty of just letting go.
There's just something a little sophomore year about the composition of this section. And as I was saying before the clip, I know that this format may not allow it, but there is no mention of Gary Gilmore. There is no mention of the Executioner song. And there's just something unsatisfying about...
Well, you're saying that, you know, it was sort of like, you know, sort of on the nose and a little sophomoric. And once again, I feel like this is something that would not be striking us as hard if this were a podcast, because I do think that podcasts in a lot of ways are a little more on the nose and can be a little more mawkish, and we sort of allow it because, you know, it's just, you consume it a different way and you have sort of a different level of expectation. And that's, you know, another reason that when you're there staring at the screen, you just expect more subtlety because so much of the story is told visually. And so I feel like all of this would have been bothering you less if it were just an audio format.
Yeah, I think you're dead on there, because I think, first of all, audio sometimes can feel more personal and intimate because it is right in your ear and you're like being spoken to directly in a way that you may not feel with a visual documentary. And the other thing is that the audio format being just audio has a lot more work to do. So on the nose, music cues and transitions like this don't feel as on the nose, or like you need the nose because that, like, you only have the ears.
Yeah.
So to say. So yeah, I think you're right. I think it wouldn't bother me as much. And I also think that in the same way that you wanted more, like you wanted more text basically in the American Elections podcast and not have to have your imagination fill in as much, I think that for this, for the Fear of 13, that would work a little better to just have us, because there are those references to Gary Gilmore, and because the Executioner song is such a sort of titan, I'm sure Mailer would not care for it to be characterized as true crime. And yeah, okay, it's broader than that. But I think that you can leave those references on the table in a podcast that would have been done in this subjective and pastiche and Spalding Gray-ish a style. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, I just kind of felt like, I don't know if this entirely works unless they go even further in the Spalding Gray direction and like just put a camera on Nick Yeris and you can edit it, but you don't intercut it with any other visuals. It's just him talking. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But
that would be a tough watch as well.
Well, yeah. But I mean, Spalding Gray is like, it's not for everyone. Like,
yeah,
it can be a little unremitting, I guess. For lack of a better term. But I did enjoy this, I guess. I don't usually see material in this genre done in this way. So mm-hmm. I liked that. I liked that it was attempted, even though I'm not sure it was an unqualified success, but I also managed to avoid Googling him and what he had been accused of, except to confirm for myself that he was from Philadelphia. I just didn't want any other information. I wanted this to be able to work on me as it was. But I'm not necessarily sure I would recommend it. Is that weird? Like, I liked it. I think it was a bold choice, but I'm not sure I would necessarily tell anyone to watch it. Like, not ahead of anything else, certainly. What about you?
I don't know that I'd tell anybody to watch it, like, for purposes of entertainment, but I could imagine telling people to watch it, like, if they were working on a similar project or if they were working on something about exoneration or something like that. Like, I could imagine suggesting to somebody, oh, you should check this out if you're thinking about A, B, or C and, you know, trying to create something. Or if someone was trying to create a, you know, a crime podcast sort of that only, I think this is something that maybe, so this is coming out on Wednesday, but on Monday's Best Evidence, I talked about cop podcasts and how, you know, those only come from one side. And this is like an example of, you know, a podcast that only comes from one side, too, and figuring out a way to do that where it's clear, hey, guys, this is only coming from one side. We're not claiming that it's unbiased. This would present a good template for that in a podcast or something. And so, you know, this is something that I would suggest people watch to sort of see some best practices for a pod.
Yeah, I agree. And also, if you are working on a visual documentary, just to look at a different, less boxed approach to storytelling in the genre. I'm not sure that it's good for every story or every case, but I think to just knock loose some different ways of thinking about a narrative, it would be useful. And I would also suggest for that same like not educational purpose, but like, here's a spectrum of ways that you can tell a single story. Mm-hmm. The Jinx. Yeah. I think is instructive. Yeah. Like, that's not one I need to watch again, but it did do some things I had not seen before. So,
basically we're saying we'd use this if we were teaching a class.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure. So listeners, if you have watched this and you had thoughts about Yaris's credibility, if you were one of the people who was like, he's a sociopath, I think he did kill that woman, he just doesn't remember or care. Whatever it is that you think about The Fear of 13, including the somewhat try-hardy opacity of the title, let us know. Once again, that's at Blotter Presents. And you can always find both of us at bestevidence.fyi. Speaking of that,
in local news today, bees.
Anything else to plug, Eve? Or anything else coming up on Best Evidence that people might be excited about?
Well, people should be excited about Best Evidence all the time.
Well, yes, besides the customary.
Because it's great. It's great. It's awesome. It would make a great Christmas gift. I can put a little button in there to make it easy for you to give it as a gift. I think that many of you already subscribe, but those of you who do not subscribe and are considering a way to help support this podcast and this show and everything else that we do, it's only $5 a month, and it's good and it's worth it. And, you know, you'll be getting your money's worth, I assure you. But otherwise, I am the senior editor of Eater San Francisco. So if you're ever looking for information on restaurants, San Francisco restaurant news or whatever, it's, you know, Eater San Francisco, Google us. It's a little website about food.
Excellent. Thank you so much for coming back on the podcast.
Thank you.
Coming up next time on The Blotter Presents, it's Piper Weiss returning to talk about the long-awaited Robert Chambers miniseries on Sundance, The Preppy Murder. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and the Gram, and, as we said, at Eve's and my True Crime Review newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. Just a reminder, 2,000 paid subscribers, and that Theranos trial is covered in person by us. If you like the podcast, I'd love it if you tell a friend and rate it on iTunes or the podcast app of your choice. If you don't like the podcast, I'd love it if you keep that to yourself. My guest has been Eve Beatty, and she's on Twitter at EveB. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.